Hello, before I get this one started, I highly recommend the Eclipse poem, A Great Woman, after you've watched or listened to this podcast. All right, enjoy. I've always been a rather intricate daydreamer. Sometimes I would get so caught up and lost in the creative scenarios I made up in my head. Maybe it was a retelling of a profound memory, or maybe a creation of a short story. Perhaps poetry. I'd get so riled up and excited over the newfound fragment I created from my freedoms of thought. These tall tales of what could have been. It was my favorite pastime when I wanted to forget all about the present, even for a moment. I found myself above a river, on a glass platform ready to crack. The teasing of my humanity, being ever so slightly threatened, by the jagged eeriness of the cracks and scratches coming from the decaying glass. I stared down to see a river of black, unfamiliar and unforgettable. Below was the unknown. I was too afraid to look below me any longer, so I looked straight ahead to help myself delusionally ignore the impending doom. Ahead of me was the universe, though nostalgic in its appearance. There were also clouds to accompany the stars. Its glazing spectacle was accompanied by the smell of sand and the salty ocean. To the right of me was the way to the world. Ah, I thought to myself, this must be the culprit. To the left of me, there was me, but multiple ages of myself. Me being as of current, and the others being in different parts of the past. They all looked ahead the way I did, as if not to acknowledge me. I felt a familiar warm touch press on my back. I realized I had been tense due to the understood paranoia, but this touch was able to help me ease up a bit. I studied this familiar touch closely, the way it felt particularly big. I utilized my senses to determine that it was an open palm that currently blanketed itself on my now softened back. The palm began to apply some pressure, and I realized that whoever stood behind me wanted me to start walking on this half excuse of a platform. I seized and violently tensed up again, broadening my stance to not be swayed or moved. The platform responded with groans, and more cracks began to formulate around me. I became afraid. January is easily the coldest month of Minot, North Dakota. This place has many nicknames, one of my personal favorites being the Black Hole. The way the geography is set up, I practically lived in a bowl. It's all plain fields with hardly any trees around. The elevation was sea level, so it's easy to breathe. There is the main problem of this place. Remember how earlier I called it a bowl? Well, that's because surrounding Minot is hills and higher elevation. Air around there essentially gets pushed down to here and circulates around for a bit. So an average winter day, that typically would be like 15 degrees Fahrenheit, is now dropped down to -5 degrees Fahrenheit due to wind chill. The lack of vegetation further proves this point. Along with this newfound experience of cold, I also found that metal doesn't particularly thrive in these kinds of extreme conditions. This isn't including snow, by the way. So as I worked, I also struggled during the winter. The cold would hurt my replaced pelvic bone so bad to a point that I could hardly walk at times. And I know some of you might be wondering why I would even bother to work in these conditions, let alone tell someone about my pain. And I think a lot of that really had to do with the fact that I was too proud to speak up. If I could somehow hold up the little bit of humanity I had left, then you bet your butt I was going to try my absolute hardest to keep that going. I can recall having to shovel the work truck out from a ditch of snow while on the way to my work destination. I spent about a solid hour just trying to get it out in the -45-degree weather. This would be the first of many. I can safely say I've made it a skill when it comes to shoveling up snow because of how frequently I did it. I like to say going forward, I won't mention work as often, only because that's not really the point of all this, and the things I've learned deal with the opposite side of things. I was slowly but surely grasping back this flow and rhythm that I once had when I first joined the military. I began to regain my steps a bit. Though the hate I felt was still very rich with great abundance and potent, I still found my bearings. I didn't recognize it at first, but it had come to great concern in me that I became rather acclimated to being a very indoor sort of person. So much so that the only way I was remotely comfortable and or verbal was by being in my place of comfort. Now I know for my introverts out there, this sounds like a cold case of social anxiety, but it was actually more deeply rooted than I realized. It started off rather subtle. I would find myself in a corner to sit and eat by myself. While others would huddle up in circles and talk, I'd find myself silent and staring at the blankness of a wall. I never wanted to go out, even when invited to events. I'd quickly decline to maintain and protect the little piece that I had left. I was rather frail in my approach to people, more often than normal. I hadn't mentioned it much before, but this was a rather odd thing for the time, because before everything that had transpired, I was known for trying my hardest to put my best foot forward and was very energetic when it came to the job, gaining knowledge and relationships with others, and all around being vocal. And yet somehow things became more difficult. I'd find myself breaking out into cold sweats when a conversation dragged on too long. I'd notice the more painted details about people as they spoke towards me. I spoke little so I could avoid thinking too hard and worrying over saying the wrong thing towards people. I became rather awkward or unsure. There was this unnerving feeling that somehow, some way, I would ruin the emotions of those around me by a single breath. I became ashamed with the empty vacancy radiating from my soul. It was as though my body was unable to figure out which direction to go. I became stuck. Wait a minute. I remember my goals. I remember why I signed up in the first place. I can't forget these things. I must continue to strive towards my dreams. After all, dreams make a man solid. I tried my absolute hardest to keep that in the back of my mind as I continued to progress in my job. I was so eager to get back out there and put my best foot forward in spite of my conditions. I will call this my age of recovery. Truth be told, I was actually quite proud of myself during this run of my life. Preston and I were like a deadly duo when it came to applying ourselves and getting outside of our comfort zone. We volunteered often together, spent extra time at work applying ourselves, learning new courses, getting certified on extra jobs, even getting so good to the point we were teaching newer airmen how to do the job and how it gets done. We studied diligently when it actually came time to get tested on our job and would often hold each other accountable when it came to making sure we were well-equipped for the next day. For some reason, we were cracked out on the idea of being somewhat competitive with each other in the workplace. Preston had a big head start over me due to the fact he was coined and awarded for taking care of me when I was injured. Yours truly put in a good word for him. I guess you could say he's like a rival to me, though currently Preston has easily excelled himself to an entirely different level when it comes to his work ethic. During this time period, however, we were about neck and neck in terms of application and hard work. We did everything together, so it was pretty much lined up that way. I don't mean to talk us up, but I can't help but give ourselves some praise due to the simple fact we had lived through a troubling experience together and learned to at least give it our all in spite of the situation. In all truth, I wish I would have kept this work tempo up for the rest of the time I was here. But like most people say, I'm human. Anyways, I can recall during this time frame wanting to do a whole motivational speech on how I overcame adversity. I found myself feeling as though I had a handle on this weird thing called life. I go as far as to say that perhaps I was wise in my own little ways. I would, of course, be totally wrong about all this, but I'll express that later. So time came for me to do the speech, and honestly, with all due respect to myself, it wasn't the best in my opinion. But it was a great start when it came to me speaking publicly and to a large margin of people. There's more I wish I could have said, and some I wish I didn't. I won't go into a full analysis of everything because that would take hours to dissect, but the key takeaways for me really were the specific questions that were asked and the outlook that fell on me after the speech was done. For the most part, most questions landed on the specifics of my surgery and the metal that now resides in me. Though some were humorous questions like, does the metal detector go off at the airport when you walk through? Others actually had me thinking more deeply about the situation. One question in particular that stood out to me was the question on the aftercare and just exactly the state I was in. It was a question about my mental and physical health. If I struggled at all with anything in terms of hallucinations and trauma. At the time, I denied such things and lied to the world about how I was fine. But there was an emptiness to me that I kept dismissing. After all, I was so hyper-focused on work, I just assumed eventually all of the minor things would brush over. Maybe if I don't acknowledge the cracking glass platform beneath me, then there will be no reason to be concerned. Maybe if I look straight ahead. Maybe. Regardless, I worked tirelessly, putting my best foot forward to a point that I was getting little to no sleep. And Preston, funnily enough, was in the same boat. It should come to no surprise to anyone that at this point in time, Preston and I were so used to doing everything together that it became a routine. We would work our butts off, volunteer, watch movies, and eat junk, and pull all-nighters until the next morning where we would be running off an hour of sleep. It was like endless clockwork. Almost felt foreign to do anything outside of what we knew. Day after day, night after night, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. Though you'd think we'd get tired of doing the same old, we actually, in fact, found ourselves enjoying the unhealthy routine. We'd crack jokes about the job while joking about the lack of sleep as well. I'd like you to keep in mind throughout all of this that this was a choice we decided to make, though sometimes the job would have us feeling extremely exhausted as well. Our efforts would, of course, go on to be recognized by our leadership at the time, and we both ended up being awarded with an achievement that allowed us to promote 6 months earlier than the peers around us. It was an achievement that we both wanted badly. In fact, most of what we did was aimed towards getting that achievement. I remember our supervisors, sergeants, and chief being so thrilled and overjoyed with the fact that we both won. We stood in front of our flight and gave our speeches to motivate those that also strive to earn the achievement. While Preston gave a professional, profound piece of advice filled with stern but compassionate words of wisdom, I simply fought tears when it came around to my turn. All that came out of my mouth at the time was, I thank God for my brother. After gaining such an achievement, I found myself willing and motivated to try my hardest to make it to the academy. Even going as far as asking for emails and links that I could talk to make this thing happen. I wanted to keep up this momentum I had going for myself too. Even if it meant losing more sleep, I didn't care. I was getting none as it was anyways. I had nightmares and would often panic and wake in sweats when I even attempted to sleep. But ignore that, after all, it's not important. Sooner rather than later, it'll all go away, like when these things come and go. This was the natural order of life as I knew it, so why treat this situation any different? No way would I let something as small as this get to me. No way. I would express these things to Preston, often scoffing and laughing at myself. Why would I panic and quiver when I sit in a car? Who in their right mind turns their attention to the nothingness of an empty room? Silly me for falling for such hallucinations. This is nothing. I must make a good impression. That's why I was so desperate to heal so quickly. It's why I was so desperate to make it home. I was simply on drugs. Those tears amounted to nothing. I wasn't in my right mind. That's why I was grieving so hard. But now it's back to work for me. I have so much I have to catch up on, and there's no time to lose. Before I know it, it'll be too late. I'll find myself stuck regretting the actions I wish I could have taken in the past. I'm young. I'll make a fast recovery no matter what. I felt a buzz from my phone. Preston and I were coming back from our daily McDonald's run, which at this point was very unhealthy of us. But I pulled out my phone and checked it to see a message from my brother. Bro, Mom had a stroke. The platform beneath me began to crack more. The clouds that once formed perfect cotton white began to swirl and lose their composure. She's in the hospital. Please stop. Please, I beg of you. There I was again, the loud crack beneath me. What's wrong? Preston appeared in front of me. I hadn't realized I zoned out. My vision was so narrow to the point that Preston was all that was in focus. Everything else around me stretched in towards the center of my vision, like a lens from a camera. I was so zoned in that the things around me let off a jagged ringing. I stood still. I dare not move. The hand behind me kept pushing on my back, but I dare not take a step. I finally spoke. I tried my hardest to let out a single word. My voice couldn't conjure anything. It was as if my very soul was afraid to say anything. I looked off towards the sky. My mother, she's had a stroke. As the words left my lips in a satin prance, a knot began to swell around my neck. My legs were ready to give out, for I was ready to collapse from the shock of it all. Preston began to speak to me, but I couldn't figure out anything he was saying. In all actuality, I was in shock. I lost the concept of time and even detached from reality. My attempts and efforts at recovery were all in vain. I would go 1,000 more times dancing with death before hearing about the stroke of my mother. I lacked anything, like an empty pocket of webs, dust, and flies. If there was a rock bottom, then this was it. Before I could slip further into the abyss, my brother called me on the phone and gave me the rundown of my mother's health. Apparently, due to COVID, my mother began to experience some blood clots around her lungs that were gradually getting worse. She went to the hospital in order to get the situation fixed and ended up stroking out after the procedure. As my brother calmly explained things, I hadn't realized just how hard I was gripping my phone, damn near to a point that I could feel the blood circulating through my fingers. I felt the ringing again. I didn't care about anything else at that point. Not the job, not my career, not even my own life. I've never been so clear-headed when it came to the responses of myself. Every piece of me was in agreement about one thing and one thing only. I needed to get home. I notified my leadership about everything that transpired and was immediately met with condolences and sorrows. Many people even saying things such as, "Man, you can't catch a break." I tried as best as I could to keep up appearances and to remain strong and numb about the situation, but I was ready to run all the way back to Nevada if that's what it took. I remember there were so many hugs and pieces of advice coming from all backgrounds of life. People that I hardly knew even tried their hardest to calm me down. I was met with stories upon stories of perseverance and holding my head high. But in that moment, in all truthfulness, I couldn't care about any of it. Not that I was ungrateful. I was actually thrown off by the amount of support. But because an already crumbling version of me got this devastating news, I was put in a really bad headspace. Nothing mattered to me anymore. I instantly brought the next plane ticket to Las Vegas, Nevada, so I could rush to be with my mom. The same way she had done with me, my body wouldn't stand still. I couldn't sleep that night. Each second felt as though a lifetime had passed. What if I got another text that her condition had worsened? What if I can't call her about my day again or rant to her about the days to follow? Can't apologize about my delusions if you're gone. I don't get it. You've always been in good health. Where did all this come from? Those memories of your smile is what got me through boot camp. Mother, I beg, please, don't let my positive reminiscence become a grave yearning for the past. My eyes swelled up as I tossed around my bed. My legs shifted around roughly and tirelessly. I could have ran a marathon out of panic alone. I threw on movies to help distract myself, but it was no good. I sat still as the movie played like an endless road in the background. My phone would buzz like a muffled alarm. I'd scramble for it in desperation, bracing and wincing with each notification, only to find out it was unrelated to my current calamity. Come on, please don't tease my despair. Before I knew it, my morning flight finally happened. Before I rushed to the plane, I got a call from my auntie who had already arrived to take care and look after my mom in the hospital. Though I was in a panic state, Her presence and reassurance helped ease the edge. The whole plane ride was predictably uncomfortable, but thankfully felt quick, probably because half the time was spent zoned out in a state of separation and emotional exhaustion. It was as though I floated in a black hole, cradled as I rolled around in an endless abyss. Though I was desperate to get to my mom, I was also fearful of what I would stumble upon. The idea of seeing her in such a state was enough to make the madness commence all over again. I couldn't bear the thought to the point it made my stomach hurt. I wish I had some way to motivate myself to a stage of optimism, but my mentality was all but destroyed around this time. I dare not move anywhere due to the established fear I gained from nearly losing my life. I sat idle and bounded to my engrossed, molten tragedy. Somehow, I thought this was all my fault. My anger was misplaced this whole time, and I shouldn't have grown angry with the world. This closed seclusion came with an expensive price, one that I would never be willing to pay. This was far from heaven. This was far from everything. The plane abruptly landed, my deranged meditation, and I quickly snapped into a chase mode. I checked my phone every 2 minutes while collecting my thoughts and gathering my belongings. My meager attempts to get to my destination any quicker was prevented by the innocently clueless pedestrians in front of me, all living their lives the way I was. I finally managed to get through the crowd of innocents to get to where my cousin was waiting for me to scoop me to the hospital. I don't remember much of that car ride there. I knew he was trying to coerce with me, but nothing was really registering for me. All that I could perceive was the annoying ringing coming from my ear and the cracks and creaks from this annoying glass that withered and shaked beneath my feet. There it was, the towering dungeon that housed my weakened mother. I scrambled with my bags into the hospital. The doctors must have known I was coming because as soon as I walked in, they gave me the exact floor my mother was on. Keep in mind, at the time, I had my uniform on. Nothing of grave importance, but really just to paint the picture of the situation. I hadn't gotten out of it since the day before. I ran to the elevator and spammed the button to her floor, all the while pacing around. Please, God, let her be okay. I finally ran into her room and knocked on the door. I could vaguely hear my aunt's voice from inside and turned the knob to the door slowly. I braced myself. I looked at the veins exuding from my knuckles. I took an unpaced breath and let the door open wide and wider, allowing my eyes to adjust and study the darkened room. The TV was the only source of light. My eyes adjusted as I took the first step into the room. The only sound I could hear was the clack of my boots hitting the wooden floor as I got closer and closer to the bed. "Hey, baby," Monty said in a calm voice as she sat next to my mom. My mom rolled over instantly and gave me the biggest and warmest smile. Even in the pitch black, I could still see my mom shine through. At this time, due to the stroke my mother had, it was hard for her to formulate sentences properly. So she said very little that night, but when she saw her son in uniform, all of us in that room could understand right then and there what she said. "Hey, sweetie," she said with a joyful slur. I took a deep sigh. I was finally able to regather the little I had left of myself. I leaned down to hug my mom, trying my hardest not to lean all my weight on her. She felt weakened, and there was a noticeable difference in her stature. I could tell my mother put up a good fight, though her health was struggling. Something noble yet frustrating about my mom. She tries her absolute best to remain undercover when it comes to her health and mental stability. She's always been strong when it came to hiding how she actually felt, especially around her kids. I guess you could say I've learned from the best. After gauging the situation and actually being able to see how my mom looked physically, I could tell right away that she kept this part of her under wraps for quite some time. She wore hospital clothes reminiscent of mine and a bonnet with some fuzzy socks on. Despite the current situation, she looked comfortable and cozy. I relaxed my muscles as my auntie gave me the rundown of everything. Though funnily enough, getting the info on my mom made things a lot worse. Apparently, due to COVID reasons, my mother was significantly close to dying. Had she not gone to the hospital for the surgery at the time she did, things would have been fatal for her. So really, her stroke was nothing too crazy in the grand scheme of things. My auntie continued to talk about how she's fine, but she'll have trouble walking around properly for a few weeks. She would spend the remaining night in the hospital, but tomorrow afternoon she would be free to head home and relax. My job was to snag the keys to my mom's car and house and be ready to pick her up tomorrow. With everything established and my mother with a joyful attitude, I said my momentary see you laters and headed for her house, where I stayed up all night too weary to sleep. I can recall that night being unnaturally spooky, not due to the atmosphere in my mother's house. In fact, it was very warm when I walked in. It was actually the spookiness stemming from the stale blankness of my mind. I hadn't realized until that moment that after seeing my mom in such a state, the events after were met with static. Not a single thought crossed my mind. Simple emptiness accompanied with no imagination. I was in a state of being. I made up the construct of space by simple existence. Nothing more and nothing less. At one point, I even drifted away from my identity, only ever resurfacing to rehearse the plan to pick up my mother from the hospital in the afternoon. I hadn't bothered to look at myself and would continue this trend for a while. The afternoon finally rolled around, and I scooped up my mom to take her home. She was rolled out the same way I was and had a cane to help her leverage, though she was practically picked up and laid into the car. I drove as carefully as one could in the beautiful city of Vegas, probably the best I've ever driven at that time. We finally got her home, and I quickly went into caregiver mode. For the next 2 days, I would go on and drive around the city to get groceries, items, medicine, and whatever else my mother needed. I accumulated 4 hours of sleep during this time. With how my luck was going, I was paranoid that my mom would produce another stroke, and I was too panicked and spooked to get any rest. I became increasingly overwhelmed. Even minor mistakes like forgetting something from the store would lead me to a drowned folly. This was all too much for me. Here I was battling death and finally able to at least get back on my feet. And now I have to worry about the fine line of death my mother walked. It was one thing to wake up in physical pain and hate myself in the process, but it was another thing to see my ma, that I held in high regard, be in such a devastating state. If I could just carry her pain, even a little, I begged it would come true. I felt as though I was deserving of such a tragedy, not her. My ma could hardly stand on her own, let alone walk. When she tried, she would wince in pain. I hated the mere sight of it. I would snap whenever she attempted to do anything on her own. On top of all of this, I was still getting bombarded with messages from my job and messages from others that I no longer claimed as friends. It was all so irritating. I had people that would message me for random pieces of advice, whether it was about life or about the job at the time. I couldn't even seek refuge from the real world by going on my phone, because I was met with more problems that I had no headspace to handle. I had to explain to people that I was by no means in any regard able to get to anyone at the moment, but for some reason at the time, it didn't register for certain individuals. The only person I bothered to text was Preston. He was the only friend I messaged at the time. Statura had his own life problems to handle at the time, and I by no means wanted to add to his pile. This trend of the neglection of my own life issues in favor of minor predicaments would lead me to dreaded insanity. On my third day, on my emergency leave, I fought my hardest not to have an extreme meltdown. A meltdown reminiscent of the one I had the night I begged God to end my life. I didn't know who to turn to. At one point, I stood outside and tried to find some form of rhythm to keep my heart and sanity at bay. I tried the typical pace around I grew accustomed to doing, but every time I tried to take a step, I'd quickly retract the movement, almost like a physical stutter. I had a crazed, sporadic movement. My breathing was no better. I hated myself to no end. I was a pathetic sight. I could handle the random nightmares and hallucinations. I simply deemed it a destined curse, but this was a grave matter, one that I clearly was in no way ready to handle. What should I do? Think, you dumb, helpless bastard, think. I reached in my pocket without thinking and went for my phone. Without giving it another thought, I called my pops. The phone began to ring. The ring cut through the sporadic mental silence. It felt like forever. I stood awfully still. It was a concrete uneasiness as the routine digital rings radiated from the speaker of my phone. Finally went quiet. "Hey, big guy," my father's voice finally appeared. My mouth began to tremble while I gripped my teeth. I began to speak. "Pops, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I don't know who else to turn to." I began to speak to him about everything, the hallucinations, the unwarranted pelvic pains, the lack of sleep, the paranoia of my mother, the lack of empathy from others, the hate stemmed towards myself. Though I spoke with unmotivated dread, my father listened in deep silence, only ever speaking to acknowledge the insight I gave him thus far. After my crazed tangent, I took a deep breath and asked a question that harbored on my mind and on my heart for a long time. "How do you do it? How are you able to go on about your life, knowing that others won't acknowledge your pain? That you have to neglect how you feel in favor of others? How's that fair for a man to live this way? I'm drowning." He responded with silence. Then he began to speak. "You're right, son. A man will often have to hide how he truly feels in order to help those around him. Truth be told, it's a thankless role." His words didn't satisfy me, but he continued. "But just know, you are hurt, son, even when you feel as though you aren't." He continued to calm me down with his fatherly advice, telling me that as I get older, I would reflect on moments such as these as testaments to my strength. Though at the time, I only found this segment of my life as weakness and despair. After the talk, I went back inside only to see and hear my mom groaning in pain as she laid on her bed. I instantly ran over to comfort her, already regretting the time spent loathing and ranting about my life. She took her meds and slowly mellowed out. I asked her what she wanted to eat. At the time, I was in so much painful shock that things around me started to become awfully numb. In fact, I was so depressed that tears were no longer enough. It was like the pure anguish of it all made me forgetful on how to cry. Mama saw as my attitude changed and warped into an elevated version of loathsome madness. She studied me more than I studied myself, smiling as she did. She would place her hand on my face to calm me down and talk to me like warm soup on a cold day. After she told me what she wanted to eat, I quickly grabbed her some, all the while realizing I hadn't eaten all day. I handed my mom her food and went into hiding in the guest room where I currently resided. I scarfed down some chicken nuggets and fries. I only got down half a nugget before I felt sickened, and then an unnatural, fearful thought came over me. What if when I leave, something like this happens again, and I'm not able to make it in time? With how my luck was, and has been so far, there's no doubt that the odds of death are higher than 20%. I began to be fearful of leaving. For some odd reason, I had this undying feeling that once I left my mother, she would simply drift away. I began to spiral. I tried to distract myself by shoving nuggets and fries down my face, all the while I fought tears. A knot formed so potent in my throat to a point it felt like each swallow of the food would risk me choking. But who cares at this point? It was the least of my worries. I didn't even bother checking my phone either. I would simply sit on the bed, stuffing nuggets and fries while fighting tears and snot. Each swallow took more effort as I stared into nothingness. My body acted on its own while my brain disconnected. I couldn't convey how I felt. I couldn't vent to anything and anyone. I felt that at the time my calls for help were going unnoticed and unrecognized. So I did something that I had never done before in my life. I began to write down how I was feeling. First, it started off with just single words, stuff like angry, saddened, confused. Eventually, those small, basic words began to form into basic sentences. And those basic sentences began to form into intricate stories. As I wrote how I felt, I was able to process the confused meltdown I was having. The tears were painted like refined oil pastels. My silent drops of rich tears were were abrupted by the familiar call of my name. Malik? My mother called me from the other room, and I quickly got up to attend to her. As I wiped my written tears to poise up for my ma, I was met with the same warm smile from her that I was accustomed to. Though she was still in clear, sickly pain, she still showed her grand, warm smirk. I managed a warm smile back, trying my hardest to not give up the act. I quickly asked what she needed, but was strongly surprised by her response. "I'm fine, love. I feel a lot better now." I studied her a bit and realized there was a lot more color back in her face. I knew she was being honest with me. My eyes began to feel heavy. In fact, so heavy to a point it felt like my eyelids alone dragged the rest of my body down. An odd warmth. I yawned with interruption. I placed my hand on my mother's shoulder and asked if she was sure she was okay, if she needed me to make any more runs for her. She gave me instant, repeated reassurance as if to really submit the notion that she was fine. I began to yawn again. Sand began to pour on my back. I was tired. I took one more look over with my mom and told her I was going to relax my eyes for a bit. She gave me an agreed nod and nudged me to sleep. Auntie reassured me that she would be there to make runs for my ma, and that further gave me some peace of mind. The sand began to feel heavier. I didn't think much about it. I took off my shirt and plopped on the bed. I let the several layers of blankets bury me and compress me against the mushy mattress. My vision began to feel hazy. My mother is okay. She looks fine. I'll be fine. Things began to turn black. I'll check in on her in an hour or two. Nothing too crazy. Everything went black. Instead of a nightmare, I was greeted with nothingness. A total shutdown of the senses. A total shutdown of myself. My brain couldn't conjure up even the most minuscule of tasks. Not even the conjuring and imagination of colors. A simple blackness was the screen I watched as my eyes rested and hid away from the world. I woke up. My body and muscles felt completely relaxed. I took a deep breath through my nose to smell the nice scent from the carpeted floors. I studied the guest room that I slept in. I could see some of my military photos placed on the towered shelves to the left side of the room near the corner. There was a closet in front of me that contained church clothes and nice dresses. My stomach growled like a madman. I hadn't realized just how hungry I was. I'll see what's in the fridge. I got up and threw on some clothes. I slowly paced towards the door and opened it. The pouring bright sun rushed into my room. I squinted my eyes and looked across to see the backyard sliding door open. I squinted to help my hazy vision. I could smell the bacon and eggs from a mile away. I realized that I was home, around my people and the familiar. But then I noticed something. Past the backyard door, out there on the backyard porch, there sat my mother. She sat tall, her legs folded, and her hands placed on her lap. She stared off into the distance, but not in the sense of she stared blankly, no. In fact, it was as though she looked beyond the things others could see. She looked past it all. She saw past the rustled trees, the hums of the birds, the soothed winds, the hustle and bustle of the cars passing by, even further beyond that, beyond the talks and chatters, the clicks and clacks from the steps of others, the rhymes and rhythms of the noises of humanity, beyond the clouds. She looked to the stars. She looked at peace with determination. She stood tall. The sun responded back with a smile. It was as though nature itself called to her. Like the events before never happened. Poetry. This will be something I take note of in great detail and actually make a poem about in the future. For my mother embraced death with a peaceful smile, a true warrior in all regards. I was so engrossed with the literal painted art piece at the moment that I hadn't realized my auntie was walking towards me, smiling and opening her arms up to hug me. "It's about time you woke up," she teased me. My mother turned around to see me and quickly grabbed her cane to come over and hug me. "I didn't want to wake you. I knew you were pretty tired." I felt awful because I originally intended to take a 1-hour nap. I hugged my mom deeply and told her how sorry I was. She laughed and kept telling me it was okay. You looked exhausted. It's okay. I just didn't realize you were that tired. I laughed about it, not giving it much thought. I had begun to explain to her how distracted and focused I had been at work to a point that I normally wasn't getting much rest. She told me that while I was asleep, Auntie was worried about me and wanted to check on me multiple times. But why? I responded. Well, you were asleep for almost 2 days. My mother said this with warm concern as she put her hand on my face. My eyes widened. I hadn't realized just how tired I was. 2 days? Looking back on it now, since the news of my mother's health, I can't recall a day I even got proper sleep. To now be home and have the comfort of knowing that she's in my arm's reach, I guess I really was exhausted. I feel a lot more rejuvenated now. There was even some spring to my mess of a step. Though everything seemed okay, and yes, I was well rested, the lingering unknown was still present. The numbness and despair I felt mere days ago was still rampant and roaming around my atmosphere. My philosophy became deeper when it came to my lack of empathetic substance. I aimed more dreaded anger towards myself than ever before. At the time, I had the mentality that God somehow turned his back towards me. My deepened rage only angered him more. I was entitled, spoiled, comfortable. He must have witnessed my pride and wanted me to plummet and fall, to spiral out of control and desperately claw at the walls of my stability as some final desperate attempt to maintain my humanity. My anguish must be some comedic relief to be televised, to be ignored and trampled on. It must have gotten on some list. I've lacked prayer and faith, so this must be a way to further the much-deserving punishment. God, please, though I failed you and lack the legitimate love you require of me, I beg and plead, please end my suffering. My heart can't take much more of this. The rest of the time with my mom was spent just catching up with her. We spoke briefly about my job, and I confessed reluctantly about how I haven't been the best when it came to how I feel. She looked on with concern, but would constantly give me some words of wisdom. Though she was trying her best to reassure me, I felt as though I couldn't be reached. Those words were empty. The "it'll be all right" motive felt stale and empty to me. I had to live the rest of my life in constant pain. The "it'll be okay" wasn't nearly enough to quench my thirst for happiness. And at the time, the cliche movie motivation felt like the only default answer most people would give. This wasn't to say that my mother would give me this kind of advice. In fact, at the time, my mom would spend most conversations giving me constant reassurance about her health. She understood just how deep-rooted my paranoia actually was. It was like witnessing someone constantly trying to steady an expensive vase from tipping over from one side to side. I was intensely concerned to a point that it was visible. Other than the positive pep talks, 2 weeks passed by, and I began to pack my things up to head back to work. Before I got in my brother's car to head to the airport, I gave my mom the heaviest yet most gentle hug I could muster. It was a dependent hug, one that relied on my mother's undying faith in me to make it happen. Though I was weak at the moment, her hug empowered me somewhat. It was a conversational hug, a hug that spoke, "I'm here, I'm alive," a much-needed affirmation before I would depart from her. Hilariously, we'd hug our way all the way up to my brother's car before pulling away to say a see you later. Though departing was the very last thing I wanted to do, I still had responsibilities and priorities for my job, things that I indeed signed up for. Some of the more intense emotions I had earlier somewhat subsided, but the damage was still unavoidable. The cracks of the glass began to happen more and more. It was hard to ignore, even as I tried my hardest to look in front of me. "Just remember why you joined. Remember why you joined," I kept repeating myself as I was on the plane back to the cold terrains of North Dakota. After each segmented pep talk, the nightmarish image of my mother stroking out would haunt me. I felt as though I was incapable of doing anything else without the idea of my mother not making it popping up into my brain. I got it. I'll simply distract myself with more work. Perhaps if I could continue to drown myself, then eventually the silly little feeling I got will subside. This is the simplicity I stuck with for a while. But this would be the biggest and most foolish mistake I'll ever make. I hadn't noticed, but I became even more closed off than before. I rejected humanity altogether, only ever feeling comfortable within my own space. I turned my head away from many and all feelings and things, even the most subtle of ways. For some reason, it wasn't just the idea of being around people that turned me off from the rest of the world. But in fact, it was fear. I was so scared. I couldn't misplace this feeling, even if I wanted to. Everything would conjure a side of me that crumbled, unprovoked. Whenever Preston could, he'd have to force me to socialize and get out of my own room. Otherwise, I'd remain in exile, only finding more comforts within the confines of my useless routine. I didn't say much at this time. There was a notion at the time that even me speaking could somehow cause cataclysmic consequences. I dare not move an inch. Whenever my phone would ring, buzz, even do something as a rattle, I'd quickly scramble for it. I remember at this time, I would constantly call my mother, even for no apparent reason, just to hear her voice, just to know she was alive. There were days where my thoughts would get the better of me. My very body would reactively persuade me that I missed my mother's passing. I was of no help. I would try my hardest to calm my heart rate down and slow down the rapid panics from my heart, but it was of no use. I was undeniably stressed and paranoid. In fact, that's also around the time some gray hairs began to appear around my head. Preston would often do his damnedest to calm me down and clarify just how strong of a woman my mother was. But for some reason, I felt responsible for all of it, that my mere existence plagued everyone around me. Though to some, this idea is a silly notion. And that, indeed, doesn't at all correlate to the situation of my mom. I still, in fact, thought this way. At the time, it was a sneaky, creeping feeling. Like I shouldn't at all be here. I shouldn't exist. Indeed, I shouldn't be Joshua. Some time would pass, and the nightmares and hallucinations would become more sinister, attacking my soul even more throughout the night. I would often ask Preston if I could use his car to just go on drives. At first, we would take them together, and eventually, it would end up just being me. I would drive downtown using the back roads and just let the hums of the radio distract me from all the chaos. Though I wasn't the best at driving, I was confident enough behind the wheel to not make a mess of things. Those nights felt unreal. They blended between reality and dreams. As I drove, I would find myself seeing shadowy creatures near the side of the road. It would terrify me to the point that my teeth would feel stunned. I'd slow down and throw on the brights to the car, leaning forward as best as I could to allow my eyes to correct itself. However, that wouldn't help much. These hallucinations would become more rampant the more I forced myself to be behind the wheel. Even to a point where I'd see lifelike depictions of deer that would wait for me to drive near so they could run across the road and vanish before I punched on the brakes. It's disappointing to say the least that I didn't make an effort at the time to get this all managed and corrected. But I was young and ultimately prideful. I was so desperate to hang on to what little dignity I had left to remain strong and humble around others, still trying my hardest to make that little impression I had left. Preston, being the stubborn guy that he was working overtime to bring my spirits back up. He would rationalize everything and tell me that things were going to be okay. His simplicity and straightforward responses actually had more impact on me than anything. It also helped whenever my mom would tell me that she was going to be okay. I began to have somewhat of a foothold on my sanity after a while and began to come out of my shell a bit more. However, I never stopped my nightly routine, eventually realized that I, in fact, needed to get my own car so I could stop asking Preston to use his. I was so ecstatic about this at the time. This would be my first car ever, I'd be using my own money to get it. This truly was some solid adulting. I can recall being so happy about the entire thing that Preston got a few pictures of me posing up with the car I'd eventually get. I wanted something sleek and fast, but would also be great for road trips. I fantasized about taking road trips across the country. Along the way, I'd stop to sightsee and enjoy the beautiful scenery. Glimpses of an obtainable dream would push me to getting a 2018 Silver Chevrolet Malibu. In my opinion, it's one of the most reliable Subarus in the market. I named her Selena and everything. A glistening beauty. Preston was really excited too, more than likely because I could now stop bugging him to use his car. It was a great early birthday gift to myself. It was around mid-November and Thanksgiving was right around the corner. I hadn't had a particular plan to do anything for Thanksgiving, a lot of that having to do with the fact we lived in the dorms. But Preston would bring up this solid idea. He told me that a relative of his, who's also in the military, lives in South Dakota, and is throwing a Thanksgiving dinner. We were both invited to come. At first, I was hesitant, but Preston pleaded a good case. He told me that we could wake up early and road trip there on the weekend we were off. I could take half the ride and he could take the other half. He told me that this would be good for both of us. We could get away from work and all the stress that it included. Essentially, just decompressing from it all. I was very curious to see how well Selena could handle the road, so I volunteered to use her as our form of transportation. Once we had this all set and planned out, we began to pack up for the weekend, making sure we had all the essentials for the 6-hour drive from Minot, North Dakota, to Rapid City, South Dakota. The remainder of the week was spent talking all about the things we could do there, the food, the places, the scenery and sights, the actual Thanksgiving meal. Apparently, Preston's relative was an officer in the Air Force and was also really excited for us to come by. I was really excited by the time it was Friday. I pleaded and begged for Saturday to finally arrive. It was 5 in the morning, and Preston and I began to dress and get packed. I didn't miss a beat. I had my bags lined up and ready to go at the front door. All I really needed to get was my phone charger. We hopped in the car. I told him I would take the first half. Preston was still half asleep and reluctantly nodded his head while pushing the passenger seat back as he could adjust and rest. It was still dark out, but the moon glistened well. Off we went. I sang along to the music that played gently through the radio, humming along softly so as to not wake up an out-cold Preston. The first chunk of the ride, I tried my absolute hardest to zoom through. I was ready to be settled in Rapid City already. I drove past smaller towns and zipped past farm homes. The moonlight illuminated the trees and buildings and helped outline everything well for me. I didn't plan to make any stops, at least until we made it there. It was my first road trip ever, and I had simply planned to just rush through it. I wasn't speeding, however, because regardless of how quickly I was going, I still lacked the confidence to trust in myself, who often hallucinated. An hour passed, then two. Before I knew it, it became dusk. I couldn't see the sun, but I could manage to see a dry, blackish-blue tint appear in the sky. Fun fact about the road between North Dakota and South Dakota, there's virtually nothing around, mainly trees and vast plain lands with the occasional lake. Most roads will run endlessly, and you can easily find yourself being stuck on one road for hours. This would be the case for us as I sped my way across the boundless lane of concrete. I turned up the music a bit to keep myself awake and aware. We only had about another 3 hours or so. I might as well drive a tad bit more. Preston looks pretty exhausted, I thought to myself. More and more trees began to surround the road. First, there was a few bunches here and there, but it began to pick up more and more. Soon enough, on both sides of the road, there were trees that hovered over us. I began to slow down. I didn't know what awaited us in the distance. The dusky fog set in as I drove cautiously. I sat upright and scanned the road. Though I slowed down, I also made sure to not linger too much in one area, trying my hardest to be hasty yet vigilant. The trees grew thicker. The fog began to rise. As my headlights led the way, I began to squint to make sure I could see any weird movements or reflective lights. The road hummed gently along with the lowered music. I no longer sang along. To the near right of me, I could see an odd, faint green glow beam towards me. I punched the brakes as hard as I could. I knew instinctively that this was no mere figment of my imagination. No, in fact, it was a book near the side of the road. I began to become overly cautious as I approached the book. The moment the lights to my car clarified the furred creature, I also noticed three others that stood beside the book. It was a family's worth of them. It should be all of them. I began to drive towards the left side of the road as a means to avoid any possible collisions with them if they happened to be startled. I watched them as they maneuvered, and I passed. Once I passed the third deer, I began to speed up, trying to get out of the group of deer that surrounded the forest. I finally turned my head to focus back on the road, and what was waiting for my eyes was a lonely deer placed only a mere feet away from me. My eyes shot open, and I quickly jammed my foot on the brake, all the while clenching my jaw. The deer simultaneously began to scramble away, only to meet the front end of my car. A loud crash reminiscent of an explosion rang out, along with the heavy impact of the deer thrashing both of us back in our seats. The tires screeched and screamed as our helpless bodies thrashed forward, only being caught and braced by the seatbelt. The steering wheel became immovable and stiffened. I gripped the wheel hard and used all my force I could muster to combat the violent swerve of the car, all the while cursing. Eventually, the car steered and skidded again, and managing to slowly come to a halt. Preston, in a panicked state, looked around with a bulging vision. "What was that?" he said in a panic. The car stalled and it completely shut off. Even the radio shut off, like a phone malfunctioning from water. The hum of the road was gone. It was quiet. My body was quaking. My breathing stiffened. We both slowly got out of the car, keeping our eyes glued to the missing front of my car. Dusk was upon us, but there remained no sun, though the fog became more and more prominent. I slowly walked to the front and placed my hand on the car. I didn't know how to react, only feeling on the aftermath of my reality. Like a sponge trying to suck in water, I too was digesting this moment. The world around me slowed down everything. Even as Preston quickly began to speak, his voice became that of a muffled mess. My hand remained on what was left of my car. I didn't bother to pan my eyes anywhere else aside from where my hand laid. The cracks of the glass echoed. My eyes widened. I looked over at where the deer laid, its body now no longer moving, lifeless. What was once life, I took foolishly. "It's dead," I heard myself speak. "We could have died," I winced. "You would have been responsible for the death of your best friend. Stop it. This was your fault. You didn't pay attention. Please." The floor began to crack some more. "Don't you see? Those around you are put in danger, and it's your fault." "I know." "Stachura nearly died. Then your mother, and now look. I'm begging you, please, look at it." I looked over to where the deer laid, but instead all that laid there was my mother. "Look." My heart began to quicken, and my stomach dropped. "You've only had this car for a week, and you can't even do that right." I felt my hands clench. "Josh, we should sit inside." Preston rang out as he looked around panicked, trying his best to sit inside the broken car. "Look, he's scared because of you. We could have been in Rapid City, but because of you, we aren't." I started to exhaust air, verbally breathing in and out, hard. None of this would have happened if you weren't here. Preston would be with his family. What's wrong with you? Even now you sweat like a deranged maniac. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? I began to pace around, breathing hard, as this thing in my head continued. You would be better off alone. Away. Gone. I stopped. Everything around me melted. The glass looked close to shattering. I stared up in despaired, belligerent confusion. Oh, I finally responded. I should just be gone. I screamed out loud in a spiraled frenzy, screaming into nothingness, screaming into the fog. There were no other cars around, just Preston and I and a dead deer. I turned towards the car where Preston waited in earnest concern. I sat back in the car and put my face in my cupped hands. The scream took it out of me. I had nothing left, just anguish. Preston began to speak. It's going to be okay. We are alive. You didn't know these things would happen. I ignored his pleas. The rest of the time was spent calling my insurance, getting a tow, and driving my broken Selena back to a tow yard. My insurance company gave me a quick rundown of how I would be able to get repaired. I should only have to pay the deductible. I feel awful thinking back around this time because we actually got quite a bit of help from others that drove past. A cop was able to help us move the car off the road, and a group of farmers were actually the ones to do most of the calling. Heck, even the tow driver was just trying his best to crack jokes to me and lighten up the mood as he drove us back to the nearest city. At the time, though, I couldn't think of anything meaningful. I was in an empty space, a concept with no substance, no purpose, just emptiness. We finally got back to the town and were dropped off at a truck gas station, which was complete with a food court. I sat down on the concrete pavement and Preston had to drag me in and sit somewhere more comfortable, all the while keeping what little of me was left afloat. I was angered beyond repair. I couldn't afford to be angry with the world, only with myself, that causes calamity wherever I go. I no longer needed a reason to live. Yo, it's Mama Lo. Preston nudged me with the phone in his hand. Great. Now I have to explain this to my mom, who I already don't want to panic. I clenched my jaw to the point it hurt and grabbed the phone while shaking. I moved it to my ear without saying a word. Malik? My mother began. Hey, I responded with a grudge. At the time, I was expecting my mom to give me the same spiel I became accustomed to hearing. The everything will be okay talk. The one that was supposed to uplift me and motivate me. Yet what could she possibly say for this? For any of it? For the pain in my hip, the near loss of her life, the reopening of a scar. What could one gain from a bunch of positive rambling? I waited. Josh, you have every right to feel the way you feel. My mom put it simply. All of a sudden, all the anger within me was gone, and I became hollow. I was completely shocked with the answer. This whole time, I would imagine that the answer was to simply get up and be okay, never acknowledging the other inherent emotions that we humans harbor. That simple response lifted the curtain of anger, and I began to cry. Not just a few tears, but a cry of guilt, a cry of awakened reality. I cried because I was alive and well. I cried through honest apologies. I couldn't muster the strength of anything else. Though I lost my car that day, I began to understand what it meant to be human, to be vulnerable. Once the phone call was done, Preston came around and cheered me up. And truthfully, I began to be so thankful for his presence, to know that he was alive and okay, that we were still there to laugh in spite of the situation. Yes, to be human. My supervisor at the time scooped both of us along with all our stuff, and we unfortunately headed back home. I apologized earnestly to Preston's cousin, who was waiting for us the whole time, but was very understanding about the entire situation. And there I was, carless yet again. I didn't think much at all the remainder of that day, due to the calm down of shock. and that Sunday was utilized solely around trying to get things gathered with my car situation. My mom would call me all throughout the day to check on me and make sure I was still okay. That Monday, there was a mandatory work meeting that everyone had to attend. And I'll be the first to admit that I strongly didn't want to go. I hardly wanted to get out of bed as it stood. I remember being somewhat embarrassed to show my face due to me having somewhat of a reputation at that point as the guy that didn't catch a break. I remember slowly walking up to the theater that led to the meetings. I had decided to walk all the way there from my dorm because I didn't want to bother anyone for a ride. The sun was slowly coming up and the air was cool, early spring breeze. Though it was a bit chilly, it wasn't entirely cold yet. The winter would be right around the corner. I walked with a swayed pace, purposefully elongating my journey towards the crowd of coworkers. I stared at my feet and dared not to look forward. Each step made me more anxious and brought more shame upon me. The faint chatter became more prominent, so I finally made my way to the building, all the while never looking at the crowd before me, and still painting my eyesight towards my worn boots. I finally heard someone call my name from the crowd and decided to look up in a delirious look of curiosity, as if I hadn't known who spoke to me. Come to find out, it was one of my coworkers who worked along with me and my squad. They huddled around me and began to ask about the car accident. I managed to put forth a smile and explain how everything unfolded, all the while trying to joke and gesture the way I normally would. The building curiosity began to spread amongst the people that were there, and soon enough, more and more guys huddled around us, eager to know the finer details of my triumphant journey. Laughter broke out, followed by the same dialogue from each person. "Man, you can't catch a break." I began to laugh as I agreed along with them, quickly responding with "I knows" and half-baked giggles. The chatter, unfortunately, would carry through the entrance of the theater and even all the way to the inside. What once started with just my coworkers grew into my leadership. Eventually, my new senior and commander approached me. It felt like a broken record as I responded to the same responses of pitiful remorse. I would nod and laugh and look away as I tried my hardest to find reason to humor the situation. But my laughter began to wither like the last leaf of fall. Eventually, I started to become quiet. I began to reminisce on just what happened that day, the rage I felt, the anger and tears, and the unforgivable thought I had towards myself. "Hey, buddy, how you holding up?" I hadn't realized my senior approached me to check on me. I looked at him with a tired expression and smiled. "I'm fine, sir. It was just a car." As I said this, my voice cracked and sheltered itself back behind my throat. My senior, as sharp as he is, wasn't too convinced and asked a question that acted as my tipping point. He moved in closer as if he was attempting to tell me a secret, placed his hand gently on my back, never breaking eye contact. "Are you actually okay?" he asked with a deepened tone. The question didn't feel simple, like the other variants which were asked before. This question was backed by the layers of pain that I've had kept a tight lid on up until now. After all, up until this point, I've never bothered to express the emotions I shared with you guys to anyone at work. It was like a forbidden action. The question cut so deep in my soul that my body quaked, my vision tased as I stood stiffened. For some odd reason, the sharp pain in my pelvis numbed up. I managed to look at my senior. Without saying a word, I simply nodded. My heart hiccuped with each nod. I could feel myself beginning to melt. I quickly turned around and scurried away to sit down in a seat far away from everyone else. For some reason, though, that question sparked more than just a deepened pain. It surfaced a nakedness that felt more embarrassing than vulnerability. Though I was away from the crowd of people that slowly began to sit down and converse with their friends, I still felt a big spotlight hovered above me, like a clown that has to dance in order to survive. I couldn't shake this feeling. Everything began to tower over me and look down upon the mess that was me. I looked around with a subtle panic. I tried my hardest to convince myself that the people around me weren't staring at me. I began to sink in my chair some more, trying to hide the nakedness of my insanity. I started to hear the echoes of my cataclysmic thoughts from the day of the accident. What was once whispers from before began to yell at me. I started to clench my eyes closed as a way to swat the impending doom. You should be gone. Look how they laugh at you. I tried to remain calm as the replaying of the crash began to boom in my head. It became so lifelike, like the event seemed to disrupt the current reality. It was as though I was thrown back into the accident. They laugh at your mistakes. The voice of me egged me on. I began to feel my panicked, swayed breathing come back. Please, not here. Not now. They can't see me like this. The glass was on the brink of breaking. It scratched and stirred beneath my feet as I palmed my ears shut, trying to deflect the eerie haunting noise. My vision began to scramble. The people around me seemed to get bigger. Though it was obvious they weren't looking at me, they seemed to swirl and spiral towards me. I sank deeper in my seat, almost getting ready to kick my knees up. You need to get out of here. You need to be away. The thoughts began to hasten my anxiousness. I have nowhere to go, I responded. The glass started to fall by pieces. I looked to my left to see the weight of the world grow heavier. I looked to my right to see the different timelines of me begin to look at me. All of their eyes stared in unison. I began to panic more. The eyes. Damn it, don't look at me. The hand behind me began to push me harder, but I dared not move. The platform looked frail, as there was little glass left. Below my feet, the waves began to scream in anguish. The tides grew bigger, my legs began to shake. The breathing became more sporadic. I clenched my chest as I started to see Preston, scared after the deer hit the car. I started to see my mother frail on the hospital bed. I began to hear my screams as I laughed and cried with the missed opportunity of my death. I must be cursed. Some filth that's mere existence brings calamity. I mustn't take a step. I'll only bring more death to those I love. The hand behind my back began to shove me, attempting to push me as hard as it possibly could. I bent my knees to combat the force that wanted to risk my life. I'd rather not move. The waves of the abyss screeched in response, as though it was ready to chew me whole. My breathing was abnormal. The eyes of the world and the eyes of me surrounded me. What lurked around each corner were more lights that aimed towards my nakedness. You should be gone. There goes that rampant thought again. I clenched my eyes tight as a last-ditch effort to block out everything. Today we will be talking about suicide prevention. The host of the meeting cut through my thoughts. The glass beneath me broke. And there I was, free-falling. I reached my hand out as high as I could, trying to grasp for something. Anything. Even air. But nothing came. The weight of the world free-falled with me as an accompanied guest. Funnily enough, the different timeline versions of myself somehow managed to fly while I fell. All of them no longer looked at me as I spiraled, but instead looked onward. I fell with tremendous force. It was as though physics itself was unforgiving towards me. As the abyss of waves began to swallow me whole in the spiritual, the physical part of me simply got up, began to walk out of the theater. I couldn't see anything else. Only me that now had nothing. The waves began to drown me as I opened the exit door. Each step I took represented the gasp for air with my flailing arms. I couldn't swim in this chaos. I stood outside of the theater as the wind hit my skin. The abyss darkened my vision. I looked towards the rising sun and allowed it to hit my face. My body began to numb up from the swallowed darkness. I stood still. Life drowned me. The wind hit my face with a knife of chilliness. And I finally noticed the unprovoked tears that slid down my cheeks. I wiped them calmly and with reactive emptiness. My eyes felt stale and stiff from the cold. My eyes backed heavily from the lack of sleep. My lips were cracked and chapped. I've always been a rather intricate daydreamer. Sometimes I would get so caught up and lost in the creative scenarios I made up in my head. Maybe it was a retelling of a profound memory, or maybe a creation of a short story. Perhaps poetry. I'd get so riled up and excited over the newfound fragment I created from my freedoms of thought. These tall tales of what could have been. It was my favorite pastime when I wanted to forget all about the present, even for a moment. I grabbed my phone and it began to ring. As the tears fell and I looked at the beauty of the sunrise with a gray expression, I listened to the monotone hum of the rings. My pops answered the phone with a warm, "Hello?" I remained silent for a couple seconds to let his answer echo. I took a deep breath and spoke with calm affirmation. "My soul is tired, Pops. I think I'm gonna go to therapy."